You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of January 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme. Global protests against President Donald Trump's migrant ban continue. We'll ask whether his policy is anything more than a crude assault on the US Constitution. Also ahead...
What we are advocating is engagement with the government of the most powerful nation on earth, on which the security of the world depends.
And is the UK government preparing to roll out the red carpet for Donald Trump because it's desperate to negotiate a trade deal with him? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's executive editor, and Brian Klass, a fellow in comparative politics at the London School of Economics. Welcome both to the programme. So really only one place to start, of course, Donald Trump and his executive order banning people from seven countries with a Muslim majority from entering the United States for 90 days. The order has sparked controversy, chaos and confusion in almost equal measure, and it's forced people around the world to take to the streets in protests. Well, Steve, we'll start with you quickly. It has been a shambolic weekend. Do you think that the Trump team can be pleased with the way the story has unfolded?
Well, they will say they are, but they really shouldn't be. It was a terrifying mix of chaotic and nasty. The Secretary of Homeland Security found out about this policy by watching TV. Even he wasn't told what was happening. This seems to have been drafted by Stephen Bannon and Stephen Miller, two members of the alt-right, the white supremacist right, who, you know, Steve Bannon just a year ago was running a fringe website, and now he is the chief strategist for the President of the United States. What has been heartening in some ways is the reaction since Friday night. Not just in America, where thousands of people all over the country came to airports to stand united and to say that refugees were welcome, but also around the world from the leaders of America's traditional allies. Angela Merkel repeatedly, not just on that night, but ever since then and today again, has spoken about why she thinks this is wrong and how it doesn't fit with liberal Western values. France has done the same. Italy has done the same. We'll come on to Britain in a moment. Theresa May certainly failed her first test by refusing to comment on it when she was first pushed. But I think we're seeing, as we have done since Trump was elected, we're seeing people stand up and say, we're going to actually fight for our values. So that's the one crumb I take from this weekend.
Brian, perhaps you could explain first, you know, to our listeners, we keep on hearing about executive orders. How much of US government can be run by one man signing pieces of paper? It's interesting to see just how many he's signed. You know, he criticised Obama when Obama was in power for doing too many, but I think he's almost done the same amount already in the first few days. How much of government can be just, you know, boiled down to these orders?
Right. So executive orders are part of the presidency where they're able to make law, particularly with foreign policy, without congressional oversight. And the reason why foreign policy is so much more susceptible to executive orders is because Congress has the power of the purse, which means that anything that costs money has to go through Congress. But executive orders can be applied to things like immigration. Now, they are subject to existing law and they are subject to the Constitution. So if an executive order goes in the face of either of those things, it's not going to be actually implemented. But the executive branch in the United States, the presidency, has the power to implement and enforce nuance of law. So if you get sort of a, we're going to do this, and that's the directive from Congress, the president has the power to interpret how that will be enforced. And that's where the executive orders came out on this issue. But let's also keep in mind, Obama did an executive order about every 10 days. So, they added up over his presidency. Trump has been much more aggressive in pushing them very, very quickly. But it's sort of par for the course in the sense of executive orders do come out much more quickly in the early days of a presidency. What Trump has done, though, is make major sweeping changes, and that's less usual.
And just tell me, the testing of those, as you say, there are legal restrictions. The ACLU over the weekend, they went to court. They got a judge to say that actually people who are about to be deported shouldn't be sent home. There should be a stay of execution, as it were. How many of these executive orders do you think are going to run up into bumpers like that, are going to be shaped and redefined over the coming days?
Many of them will. And it's because Trump is being completely boneheaded in how he's implementing them. And what I mean by that is he's basically not consulting lawyers who can ensure that his executive orders will get through. When he doesn't even consult his Secretary of Homeland Security on how to implement this and doesn't consult, the Department of Justice's legal experts, then he's setting himself up to fail in the courts. And, the ACLU is ready for it, and they beat back the order over the weekend. But I think this will go through a constitutional test, because there is an argument to be made, clearly, that this is a Muslim ban, because the executive order involves less restrictions on religious minorities from the 7 Muslim majority countries, which explicitly means non-Muslims, right? And as soon as they put that in the law, it came up against basically the idea that we have freedom of religion in the United States, and that's one of the key founding principles of the United States government.
Steve, the way that it's worked out has not looked good from within the US, and certainly from not abroad. But now let's get back to what he's trying to do here. Let's presume there is something. He's trying to do something which is make America safe in some sense. Now let's unpick that and see if I can argue Mr. Trump's point, which is to say,
good luck.
Okay. We all pick these countries because we see not only kind of people who are setting off bombs come from them, but people who are involved in the Muslim Brotherhood, people who are involved in being hate preachers coming to the US, and we have very few restrictions on them. They have managed to get through the net. Let's just hold off for 90 days. Let me just kind of look at the system and make sure that we've got enough checks and balances in power. And I'm sorry, this is going to cause a bit of confusion, but for 90 days, you're just going to have to hold your breath, and it may mean you can't come back to your education system, or you may not be with your wife for a few days. But we need to do this on behalf of America. What's wrong with that?
Well, let's leave aside what's wrong with the idea, and let's look at what's wrong with it in practice. Number of terrorist attacks carried out in the US by people from Somalia, 0. Number of terrorist attacks carried out in the US by people from Sudan, 0. From Yemen, 0. From Syria, 0. From Iran, 0. From Iraq, 0. And from whichever the 7th country is, which I've forgotten.
Libya.
Libya, 0. So he cannot try to make the argument that these are nations that have sent, as he might put it, terrorists to America to attack America on its homeland, because they haven't. There's no basis on that. And if you wanted to look at countries where terrorists have come from and killed people in America, well, one of them would be Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 attackers on September the 11th came from Saudi Arabia. He hasn't decided to block anyone from Saudi Arabia. In fact, if you look at the Muslim majority countries where he hasn't, they are all also countries where he does business.
But Brian, wouldn't he just say, okay, fair enough, that's because we've been lucky. But you look at Paris, you look at Brussels, there, many of these, for years, these communities were ignored. They were allowed to bring in preachers who were opposed to what, the majority of Belgians or French people believed. They were able to build up networks and cultures and divert young people into radicalism. We're going to put a stop now. We're going to wait 90 days to make sure we don't even get to that stage. He's not saying they've killed anyone. He's saying we're going to stop it before it comes here.
So Trump is trying to make the point that this is the first step of something that he calls extreme vetting. What he doesn't say is that the vetting process for refugees now takes 2 years and 20 different checks that often involves up to 17 different government agencies. It is the most difficult thing to get into the United States as a refugee. And that's different from Paris, right? There was a massive influx of refugees with very little scrutiny in the wake of the Syrian conflict, and it did create many problems, right? But in the United States, you have to come in on an airplane through a very proper channel. It's not like people coming in via boats unchecked. And on top of that, the actual threat posed, I think, is very minimal. So the question is, okay, we already have a process in place that's got 20 checks in 2 years. What does an extreme version of that look like? And the thing that really worries me, the thing that I think is part of the grander strategy, so to speak, with Trump, is he's painting this as a national security issue, as a threat from foreigners. But the big attacks in recent years have been from Muslim Americans that grew up in the United States. And what I'm worried about is, God forbid, another terrorist attack happens and another one along the lines of Orlando or San Bernardino with an American citizen involved. Who is Trump's next target? Is it American Muslims? And that's something that no one's talking about, because he has, you know, put a target on the back of Muslims abroad, and I think now he's putting a target on Muslims at home, and I think that will be the next logical step.
Steve, just diving in there, so I'm enjoying personating Mr. Trump. So what I'll say to you is, okay, we can waste a lot of money doing all these checks on every country from around the world, but in the end, profiling kind of works, because, you know, we saw it here in Europe after many of the attacks, many civil liberties people saying you can't target communities, you can't target, you know, men of a certain age, you can't just target people because they've got beards, which seems, you know, which of course is understandable and probably morally correct. But on the other side, it is a bit of a waste of time stopping 90-year-old white grandmas, you know, going on a holiday to Spain and checking them at the same level. What's wrong with profiling? What's wrong with saying, actually, within these communities, there's more likelihood of terrorism. We should put our resources here.
There are a number of things that are wrong with it. Firstly, it equates everyone in a community with the worst possible person within that community. And in the same way as white Christian Americans would feel offended and having their rights violated if, because Timothy McVeigh had destroyed a federal building in Oklahoma, they were all stopped at every airport because, well, you know, there was that one white Christian guy who did this. You know, Muslims will feel similarly frustrated and angry that they are being tarred with this brush. The other thing is, it doesn't work. It's when you are looking for certain people, when you are trying to find specific people that want to attack you, that want to cause damage, you need to use intelligence. Now, just looking for everyone with the wrong sounding name or the wrong color of skin is not intelligence. It means that you are making it far harder for yourself to find the right person. And it also completely alienates a community. The best way of ensuring that that everyone is on side and is willing to help a country and help a security service root out those that are likely to commit terrorist attacks or are planning to commit terrorist attacks is the sense that those security services are willing to work with you, with your community. And, you know, we've seen it in parts of the world where those communities do work well with the police, that there are A, fewer attacks, and B, more people are caught.
Brian, when we look at these executive orders, when we look at certainly what's happened around this migration one at the weekend, and with the leaks we hear from coming out from the White House, what we read in every US paper, there is a sense of amateurism, disorganization. I've taken my blonde wig off, by the way. Amateurism, disorganization, chaos, rivalry. For critics of the Trump administration, it's kind of all good in a way, isn't it? It feels very, very shaky. It feels very unlikely that they're going to be held together in a consistent way over the coming months.
Well, the problem is that it's very easy to break things and very hard to fix things. And even though they are amateurish, they're able to make serious changes that have real impacts on people's lives. mean, one of the things I've been saying for a long time about Trump is that you have somebody who has no experience, who's surrounding himself by people who have no experience. And it's like, you know, you have, let's get rid of the pilot and let the passengers fly the plane because we don't like the route that the pilots are taking. Now, the pilot should listen to where the passengers want to go. And I think that that's a real and reasonable critique of the establishment up until now. But we still need pilots. We still need people who understand how to govern. And Trump does not. And you know, it would be so much less troubling, his cabinet picks being unqualified or his advisors being less qualified, if he were qualified. But the combination of an unqualified commander-in-chief with a person who is willfully ignoring expertise and indeed withdrawing expertise from the National Security Council this week and replacing it with a politicized figure in Steve Bannon signals to me clearly that he doesn't just think he doesn't need expertise. He's aggressively trying to purge it from his administration. Now, that does mean that he'll probably run up against a lot of problems. I mean, he will have chaos. He will have amateur hour. But he'll still be able to make laws. And at the end of the day, that's really what matters. And that's where we can't really be rooting for this chaos and disastrous policymaking over the long term.
This is the man, after all, who, when he was running for election, said, "I know more about how to defeat ISIS than the generals," and then said he had a secret plan for how to defeat ISIS, one which we have yet to see. I think one of the important things to remember at this moment, when there is all this chaos and it is amateur hour and it's also horrible, is that actually he's not popular. Yeah, you know, he has the lowest approval ratings.
People don't like him. One of the most amazing things about the weekend is like people on the streets, people at JFK, people at every airport. You know, the money that's just been given to the ACLU over the last few days is incredible. Even corporate America, especially new corporate America, whether it's, you know, Starbucks, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Apple, actually not kind of shying away, coming out and saying, this is wrong, and we're going to, you know, Starbucks saying we'll employ 10,000 immigrants. Now, that's an extraordinary beginning of maybe it's urban-based and maybe it's young, but that's the beginning of a revolt, isn't it?
It is, and I think the interesting thing over the next 2 years will be whether...
2 years because of the midterms.
Until the midterm elections, is whether... whether the Democrats can paint the Republicans in Trump's colours, whether the Republicans in Congress try to disassociate themselves from him and say, well, look, we're going to be the check and balance on him. We're going to be the ones that are sort of, don't worry, we've stopped Donald when he's gone a bit too far, therefore it's okay to re-elect us. Because that's the key thing, is what happens in 2 years' time. Look, if he's going to last 4 years, if he's not going to last 4 years, he needs to be impeached or the 25th Amendment needs to come into play. That's only really going to happen if he is so catastrophic that the Republicans think they're going to lose office, or if actually he's so catastrophic that the Republicans do lose office and the Democrats come in 2018 and could actually start some sort of impeachment hearings.
Brian, how awful was the weekend, do you think, for Theresa May?
I think it was really, really difficult for her. I think that, you know, coming off of that state visit, which was supposed to be this early political win post-Brexit for this nice piece of news that we're going to have a soft landing and there'll be a US-UK trade deal, the debate shifted very quickly to values. And I think it's going to be a problem that plagues her administration, because effectively you can have, you know, she's in a corner. You cannot turn your back on the EU and the US at the same time and have no economic consequences. That's just simply impossible. So it is a very difficult political moment for her. But at the same time, if she doesn't stand up to him now, it's not like this is going to go away. There are going to be repeated violations of what British people feel are their values in America over the next 4 years. And at some point, you know, allies standing up is something that can actually moderate Donald Trump, right? If there are real costs, if Britain says, look, this is not okay, we are going to downgrade our relationship if you continue down this path, with clear benchmarks of what it means, right? What it would look like and how they would respond, that can actually moderate Trump's influence. And so I think that it is incumbent across Western Europe for allies to say, we reject this.
I just want to ask you, do you think Theresa May has any morals? No, because when she came into Parliament, yes. You know, she came to power as Prime Minister, as someone who had a strong moral compass. Now, the reason she got messed up at the weekend is she didn't know what she believed in. So she went and held hands with Donald Trump, and it was an absolute love-in. Then when she was asked questions about whether this was the correct decision or not, she couldn't answer it because she could not refer to her moral beliefs. She had to think in her head, is this cash in the bank for Brexit Britain? And because that was the only thing that she was thinking about, it overrode all of her moral compass and she was absolutely lost.
I think you're right. And I think I'm sure she has morals. I don't want to say she doesn't. But let's not forget, this is also the politician who, when she was Home Secretary, sent vans around majority immigrant areas in the UK, which said, go home or face arrest. She's the Home Secretary who made a speech that even the Telegraph thought was far too to the right at a party conference a couple of years ago. And she talked about a problem of immigrants in schools who don't speak English, despite the fact that there was very little evidence for that. She has a problem, and it's a problem that many prime ministers in the UK have faced, which is, I think they fail to understand they can actually stand up to the US. Tony Blair could have stood up to George W. Bush more than he did. I think she could stand up to Donald Trump, not in a, you know...
But also, yeah, Donald Trump, the whole weekend was awful. You know, off she then trots to go and see Erdogan, a man who locks up any journalist who dares to express any criticism.
But we sold him some weapons, so... I know,
which he'll kind of use by fighter jets to bomb the Kurds who we're supposedly supporting. Apart from popping in and seeing Duterte on the way back, that would have been the triumvirate. That is a lack of moral sense. Brian, I wonder if when you look at this a British Prime Minister who turns her back on people with European values to sell Britain short for a bunch of countries where human rights are unquestionably being threatened in huge ways in Turkey. There's a terrible situation for many people there. And there she is kind of having like nice, cosy meal and then holding hands with old pudgy Trump. That must look awful for Britain around the world.
Yeah, and I think she's going to be hearing in this hour, there are thousands of people outside of Downing Street making their voices heard and protesting that relationship with the United States. But I think we're also in a global moment where this is going to have to be not just Britain, right? We've had an erosion of liberal democracy around the world for now over a decade. It's been since 2006, every year, democracy has eroded globally. And I think we're at a tipping point right now. I think that we are at a point where unless Western Europe stands up for liberal democratic values, nobody will. And we're going to live in a much uglier world than we want to, because the forces of a rising Russia, a rising China, and a rising Trump are ones that can overwhelm liberal democracy around the world. And Britain has an opportunity, along with the EU, even though they're leaving the EU, Britain has an opportunity to really become a champion for democracy around the world. And I hope they do, because we're not going to see Donald Trump talking about human rights and democracy very much. And if we don't have any champion, China and Russia are going to shape the world a lot more than they are now.
And Theresa May had an opportunity at the weekend, and she still has it, even though she messed up over the weekend, in that she has talked in the past about how Britain is leaving the European Union, but we're not leaving Europe, that we're still going to be strong allies with our European partners. Well, this is an opportunity to show that we are, and to stand up with Angela Merkel, with Francois Hollande, with other nations in Western Europe who are prepared to say, these are our values and this is what we stand for. This is an opportunity for her to do that. Now, as you say, the big challenge is, can you do that post-Brexit? We had this campaign slogan, take back control. Well, we have control now. The problem is, I think we've confused control with autonomy. And so when you look at the situation that Britain has now, it kind of has to be friendly to Donald Trump, because it really does need a good trade deal.
Brian, do we have to be that friendly? Over a million Britons have now signed a petition saying that Donald Trump is not welcome to come here on a state visit. Theresa May always says, that her job is to listen to the people and to enact what they want. Is it her job to make sure that she rescinds that invitation?
Well, she's got a very difficult needle to thread. She still could. I think it's incumbent upon her to make clear the dividing lines where, if Donald Trump crosses them, Britain will no longer be friendly with the United States. I think that's amazing to say, right? Because the UK and the US used to be such close friends.
But she didn't need to offer a state visit at this occasion. No. This is like an unproven... You know, he's not quite the poor old Queen when she had to entertain Ceausescu, but, you know, it's not going to be an easy kind of dinner conversation, is it?
But it didn't need to come straight away. It's, you know, Bush had to wait a couple of years for a state visit. Obama had to wait 2 or 3 years for a state visit. You don't have to offer that in week one.
I agree with that. But I also think that, you know, Theresa May and Donald Trump need each other in a sense because they need early wins. They're both precarious positions trying to dramatically transform the societies that they govern. And the other could help themselves achieve that, right, with minimal damage. So the UK-US trade deal is something that I think is a good headline. I don't think it's going to rescue the UK from Brexit because it's a tiny fraction of UK trade compared to European Union trade. But it's a great headline for Theresa May, right? And for Trump to be able to say, we're going to do a fast-track trade deal, we're going to provide new transatlantic opportunities, and it's going to provide the shot in the arm the British economy needs. If Theresa May doesn't get that and the loss of the single market proceeds, as most economists expect it will, she might be politically in very dangerous territory. So I'm not saying that she should, you know, invite Trump and, you know, be seen holding his hand at every available opportunity, but she needs to act very carefully out of pragmatism. I don't think that means that you don't stand up to Donald Trump on values questions, though, because friends tell hard truths, and that's what Britain needs to do. They need to say, you know, we want you to be the best you can be so that we can be the best we can be. And that means we both need to support our basic values. And Donald Trump's getting that pushback from the country he is in, too. The Republicans are saying that to him. So I don't know why Theresa May can't take that same line.
Steve, you know, she says that she got, you know, this agreement from him that he's, you know, going to support NATO. You know, there's a special relationship. They managed to phone at the weekend, the team, and make sure that, you know, British people, again, you know, a really kind of awful story that it only became probably apparent to how awful this was when she realised that some of her own MPs potentially would not be able to go to the US. Do you think that she will be able to have his ear on any of these issues, or does he just, you know, blow with whatever kind of Fox TV saying that day?
She will have his ear for as long as she is talking to him. And then as soon as he puts down the phone and talks to someone else, they will have his ear. And yes, it may well be Fox News. It may well be Stephen Bannon. It will not be someone of a liberal bent. And that's the problem with Donald Trump. Yes, like when he was standing next to her, he said that he's 100% behind NATO. Well, we'll see.
Steve, Brian, actually, a long time ago, there was a TV series here, which was about Nixon, and I think it's 20 years ago, and it ended with an odd thought, which was an American president, potentially so popular, thought he was so popular, and the control of both houses, that might try and change it to three-term presidency. Is that feasible?
It would be very politically difficult. I think that Americans have some faith in their basic institutions, and term limits is one of them. You know, it was only implemented after FDR won a fourth term, and then at that point we started to sort of gravitate away from it. But on the other side of this, the one thing that I do think is troubling about Americans is that for some reason we like dynasties. I don't know why, but, you know, if had Hillary Clinton won, remember, we would have had Bushes and Clintons running the most powerful country on earth for, you know, nearly three decades, and already the calls are for Michelle Obama to run. I think that would be a mistake. I think that it's good to have new blood in the White House. And so I think that, you know, Trump talking about a third term is so unbelievably premature, given that he is
his attack on the Constitution. I just wonder, Steve, how do you think that the American Constitution is so strong that it will resist all this? Or do you think that that people have to be careful?
So I think the reason why I'm skeptical of constitutional changes is because it's very, very difficult to do them without anything but consensus. You have to get a two-thirds majority in Congress, and then you have to send it to the states, and three-quarters of them have to ratify it. And a lot of states are not going to ratify such a change.
So. But what happens if the Constitution isn't changed and he just stays there? Now, I mean, I know that that sounds ridiculous, but we've already seen this weekend, you know, the court order which you mentioned, Andrew, you've had people in the executive branch who are refusing to enact it. So you're already seeing a fraying of the edges of what, you know, Brian's saying about, well, we've got this Constitution, it should be okay. And I think you're probably right. And the fact that we're even suggesting this is ridiculous. But
Yeah, you're completely right in the
sense
that...
You've got 15 seconds to say it for your butt, but...
the Constitution is not a magical document, and we shouldn't expect it to be. Democratic institutions are as strong as the people who enact them and enforce them.
We're going to see how strong they are in the coming days, months, and years. But Brian Klass and Steve Bloomfield, thank you very much for joining me on Midori House today. The show, well, it was produced by Danny Giacopelli, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain